You may feel a little bit lethargic because you just had food. It's warm. So our finishing time, Donna, is what time? 4 or 4:30?
4:30.
4:30. So it's just after 1:30. So we maybe take a break halfway, give some, so you can get some either movement or put some water on your face or get some of that good American caffeine. Well, most of our caffeine is from somewhere else.
Yeah.
South America or...
I'll go out for it. Put in orders.
Put in orders again.
Hawaii is the only state that grows.
Oh, is that right?
Corona.
Ah, I didn't know that. So almost all our coffee comes from outside the United States, unless it's Hawaiian coffee. Oh, okay. That's good to know. I don't know how good it is to know, but...
My work at Trivial.
Come again?
My work at Trivial Pursuit, but...
Yeah, as important, yeah. But for her, it's not that important. Okay, so... Another background information about the Jataka tales and the stories of the Buddha's lives, past lives as a Bodhisattva. They are meant in general if you look closely, you may be able to figure out what level of practice he was at. What do I mean by that? When you first enter into let me ask you this, if you know. At what point do you enter the Bodhisattva path? It would say the path that leads to enlightenment is called the Bodhisattva path. Does anyone know? I bet Bill knows. He's like, no? Who knows? Where do you, what's the criteria, or I say criterion, of having entered the Bodhisattva path? When do you become a Bodhisattva? When you take Bodhisattva vow? Some people believe that. Some traditions, Tibetan traditions, say, oh, you've taken Bodhisattva vow, you're a Bodhisattva. That's right, not really. Anyone?
You said... I'm sorry.
There was one behind you.
Clarifying the question. Yeah. You said you become a Bodhisattva or you enter the Bodhisattva path? Or
same
those
thing.
The same thing there.
Okay. You say, if you are... You become a Bodhisattva when you enter the Bodhisattva path, so it's synonymous. What is the demarcation of having become a Bodhisattva or having entered the Bodhisattva path?
First Bhumi, that's just a step.
No, no. First Bhumi is you're an Arya Bodhisattva. On the first Bhumi, and I'll get into that to a minute, you are an Arya Bodhisattva. You've realized emptiness as a Bodhisattva. But you are a Bodhisattva before that. You said you studied a lot of Buddhism.
No.
Okay. Come on.
Are you a Bodhisattva when you can actually keep the Bodhisattva vows?
Well, it depends on what you mean by keep the Bodhisattva vows, because there are different enumerations of the Bodhisattva vows. There are different lists drawn from sutras. So the Bodhisattva shouldn't do this. But Lama Sopa Rinpoche said the real demarcation of keeping the Bodhisattva vows is to not have one moment of self-cherishing thought. Now that, so even you keep the verbally, you know, don't criticize others, well, all these different Bodhisattva vows, the root vows, the secondary vows. From a very technical point of view, if you still have self-cherishing thoughts, you've broken the Bodhisattva vows. So you might not actually be able to keep those until, wow, the eighth Bhumi, because you still have some vestiges of self-cherishing thoughts. But my question still remains, when do you enter the Bodhisattva path? When do you become a Bodhisattva? It's not. I don't mean by when time, but what's the demarcation? At what point can you say in someone's spiritual career that they are a Bodhisattva? Oh, no. You're just guessing now.
Well, I was going to say realization of the six perfections, but
no, okay. So look at it this way. You are a bodhisattva when you have spontaneous bodhicitta. You know what bodhicitta is? What is bodhicitta?
Altruistic
wish.
To help others.
No, not enough.
No.
More precise.
The altruistic wish to reach enlightenment, to be of benefit to all sentient beings.
Kinda. Yeah, it's kind of general. But I remember when I visited Taiwan only once, many, many years ago. Lama Yeshe had been invited to some conference, and he couldn't go. He asked me to go. And I went down from Taipei to Kaohsiung. Anyone have been to Taipei? Anyway, big monastery there. And it was really wonderful to see all of these Chinese monks and nuns in that Chinese Mahayana. It's kind of like a college, you know. Buddhist college. And they, most of them spoke English very well. And I'd ask them about the 12 links of dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, even some points like the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. They knew. But I asked them, what's bodhicitta? And it was like, oh, bodhicitta is like the sky, or, you know, this is kind of a little vague. So one of the interesting things about Tibetan Buddhism, as it brought a very precise, drew from the Indian presentation of Mahayana Buddhism in the Nalanda tradition, the great monastery in India, very precise understanding of the scriptures. This is all understood in Indian Buddhism also, but for instance, the text would kind of, like there's a famous verse in the Abhisamaya Alamkara, one great text, Indian text, composed by Maitreya Buddha, that when a Sangha, not a Tisha, a Sangha, went to Shita Heaven, where Maitreya is now the regent, sort of like the reigning Dharma king there, he will come down many eons from now when the Dharma is gone, Shakyamuni's doctrine is gone from the earth. He will be the next universal teacher, Maitreya. So Maitreya gave some hint. He gave five texts to a Sangha, one of which is called Abhisamaya Alamkara, Ornament of Clear Realizations, you could say. So in that, there's one verse, very famous verse, Jangshub Semni Keba, Semke Pani Shendon Chir, Yangdak Sope Jangshub De, just two lines. Semke Pani means, Semke means, is another synonym for bodhicitta. Semke means the generation of the mind, creation of the mind. It means the mind which is oriented toward enlightenment. It's another synonym in the Prajnaparamita Sutras for bodhicitta. So essentially you could say bodhicitta is, Semke Pani, Shendon Chir, for the welfare of others, Jangshub Zogpe Jangshub De, to desire, to aim for full enlightenment. So that kind of, what Venerable said is kind of encompassing that. To aim for full enlightenment out of the desire to benefit for the welfare of sentient beings, Shendon, the welfare of others, or the aim of others. Not for your own aim, you're achieving it. That's called bodhicitta, or mind generation. And there's debate about that. So there's two factors. One is the aim to achieve enlightenment. The other factor is the desire to help sentient beings. I don't know if you're familiar with the Heart Sutra, some of you recite sometime. If you have a good translation and all the words are translated, when they talk about Avalokiteshvara, it says, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara. So he's a Bodhisattva, Mahasattva. What's the difference? So Bodhisattva in some of the commentaries, they say, why? It means the same thing. Mahasattva is a Bodhisattva, or Bodhisattva is a Mahasattva. What does that mean? Bodhisattva is emphasizing one of these two aims of bodhicitta. It's emphasizing the aim for Bodhi. He's a courageous person, a sattva. Here means not just sentient being, but a courageous person aiming for bodhi, bodhisattva. Mahasattva is emphasizing the other thing about welfare of others. He's a great being, a sattva, courageous being, aiming for the great goal, mahasattva. So it's kind of giving both flavors of that definition of bodhicitta. So when you have, right now, we may be able to develop bodhicitta with effort. What we might call it artificial bodhicitta, or you might not call it artificial bodhicitta. You might meditate for a long time. You know, I've worked for myself for so many eons, it never got me anywhere. All these other beings have been my mother numberless lifetimes. They've been kind to me even when they were enemies because they gave me the chance to practice patience, developing love and compassion for them and developing a desire to alleviate their suffering. The only way I can do that is to achieve enlightenment. Some logic like this, and you might have some moments, some period of time where you have that thought, I must achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. That's called bodhicitta. But that is not yet ingrained in your mind. It's not yet spontaneous. When through familiarity, meditating through effort like that, what we might call artificial or what's the word when you make some manufactured bodhicitta, when it becomes, at the point becomes spontaneous and always there, that's the definition of having attained actual bodhicitta. You are now an actual bodhisattva. You have entered the bodhisattva path. So the demarcation of entering the bodhisattva path is the generation of spontaneous bodhicitta. Interestingly, what's the demarcation of having entered the Hinayana path?
Hinayana?
The Hinayana path, yeah.
For...
No guesses.
Oh, yeah.
No. Only if you know. You know? Just more guesses.
I'm getting it for
otherwise, you just go around everyone's. My opinion is... I'll tell you. Similar to the definition of the demarcation of entering the Mahayana path, also you could say entering the Mahayana path is the same as entering the Bodhisattva path, synonymous. Okay? Bodhisattva path, entering the Bodhisattva path, entering the Mahayana path, the moment of becoming actually a Bodhisattva, all of that is when you develop spontaneous bodhicitta. Right? Entering the Hinayana path, the moment that you develop spontaneous renunciation of cyclic existence. Have you heard of renunciation? Do you know what that means? When we talk in the Gelugpa tradition, Lama Tsongkhapa was exhorted by Manjushri to write a text about the Lan Rim, a short one called the Three Principles of the Path, Three Principal Aspects of the Path, you could say, or the Three Principles of the Path. They are renunciation, bodhicitta, the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Have you heard of that before? Yes. So, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. Right view, you could say. So renunciation, the bodhisattva also has renunciation. Some people might think, oh, bodhisattvas don't care about escaping from samsara, which is the, you know, renunciation we think of two parts also. Remember bodhicitta, out of the desire to benefit sentient beings, aiming for enlightenment. Renunciation is a little similar kind of way, out of seeing the absolute shortcomings of cyclic existence, that it's only the nature of suffering, desiring nirvana, desiring liberation. Do you see some similarity there? So twofold. So that can also be kind of artificial at first. You know, you have certain kind of renunciation. But when that becomes authentic and spontaneous, you've entered the Hinayana path. When we say path, it doesn't mean like some place that's over in Syracuse, New York, or, you know, oh no, it's in Santa Cruz. Mahayana is in Santa Cruz. Hinayana path is over in Thailand. It's not like that. It's not a place. It's a pathway of the mind that leads you to that goal. That we say the Hinayana path that leads to Nirvana, Mahayana path that leads to enlightenment. Each of those paths that lead to Nirvana and the Mahayana path that leads to enlightenment have what are called five stages, five paths. Do you know that? The five paths? Oh, have you heard? This is good. Maybe just some remedial in between the stories. So you may have heard of them. You know, Venerable, five paths? Same names for the Hinayana path and the Mahayana path, but slightly different definitions of them. Path of accumulation. Path of preparation or connection. Generally, they translate as preparation. The path of what? Seeing. The path of meditation or cultivation. And the path of no more learning, or you could say graduation. You don't have to learn anymore. You've reached the goal of Nirvana or enlightenment. That fifth path, it means you've become an arhat, you've achieved Nirvana, or you become Buddha, you've achieved enlightenment. So the
second one again.
So path of accumulation first, or collection, path of preparation, or could be translated as connection, path of seeing, path of meditation or cultivation of what you've seen on the path of seeing, and then the path of no more learning when you've achieved that goal. So on the Mahayana path, on the path of accumulation, it can be said that any bodhisattva on that path has bodhicitta within their mind stream, because that's the demarcation of entering that path. They have bodhicitta, spontaneous bodhicitta. It's not going to fade away generally. It can degenerate over time in some extreme cases until you reach a certain point on the path of accumulation. I think maybe the second or third level, I can't remember. So there's a famous story of the Shariputra. You know Shariputra? You heard? Okay, it's not that we know personally. Oh yeah, Shariputra, I met him at the Dalai Lama's teaching. Shariputra was one of the two main disciples of Buddha. He wasn't there from the very beginning. He and his dear friend, Moggallana, they had made a childhood pact that they wanted to reach moksha. They would search all the various teachers in India, and if one of them found the path, he was going to tell the other one, and they would do together. So they came after the Buddha had already achieved enlightenment, after he had some of the first five disciples and some other disciples, and Shariputra was on the path one day, and he saw this one monk. So this is like aura about him, just beautiful and calm and, you know, something. And he came up and he asked, Venerable Sir, what, you know, are you an enlightened one? And this monk's name was Asvajit. In Pali, Asaji, maybe you've heard. He was one of the first five disciples when the Buddha first heard the Wheel of Dharma. Do you know, Bill? The five disciples? One of them was called, in Sanskrit, Asvajit. The Pali simplifies that to Asaji. So he had already heard the teaching of the Buddha, perhaps was already an arhat, and Shariputra said, are you, you know, an enlightened one? He said, no, I'm just a disciple. And he said, can you give me his teachings? And he said, no, I can't do justice. And he said, just give me something. Like us, you know. Yeah. Just give me something, some tidbit. And so Asvajit told Shariputra, Ye dharma hetu prabhava hetu tishan. Do you know Sanskrit? Or again, maybe you recognize it. Hey, ye dharma hetu prabhava hetu tishan. Tata gato haivadat tishan sayo noroda evam vadi vadi shramanaya soha. So, which became enshrined, as we call it, the if you put an om at the beginning and a svaha at the end, it's called the mantra of dependent origination. We say in so many of our rituals. But it was actually said to Shariputras, is saying, of those dharmas, of those phenomena that arise from causes, the Tathagata explained the cause. And he also explained the nirodha, the cessation of those. In other words, the delusions. Mainly talking about the delusions. Delusions have causes, how they arise in the mind, the Buddha explained. Also, he explained how to cease them, the cessation of the delusions, how to achieve nirvana, how to achieve, you know, spiritual development. So Shariputra became, he told Moggallana, they both went, they eventually became the principal disciples of the Buddha. Do we have a tanka of Shakyamuni? Oh yeah, see, this tanka in the corner, you may not see, if you get a chance to look later, on the bottom, the Shakyamuni is in the middle, at the top, and on the bottom, on the two sides, are two monks holding staffs. There are, on the Buddha's right, I think Shariputra, on his left, on the Buddha's left, is Moggallana. So they were the two principal disciples afterwards. Always, in fact, it's considered whenever Buddhas appear in the world as universal teachers, they always have two main disciples. One of the reasons that the representations of Lama Tsongkhapa also have Gelsub J and Kedrup J as those two principal disciples, like elevating the Buddha, elevating Tsongkhapa to be like that, like a Buddha. So Shariputra was not a Bodhisattva. Shariputra was one of the Shravakas, the hearers who were aiming for Nirvana. Right? You know that, Venerable?
Yeah.
Shariputra, one of the hearers, Shravakas. So he was the foremost in wisdom of the disciples. Remember I mentioned in the Heart Sutra, he's interrogating Avalokiteshvara. I know, he doesn't say the words, but I kind of know about wisdom in the hearer's point of view. Selfless as a person, I'm best, foremost in wisdom of the Buddhist disciples. But how do you Bodhisattvas practice? So in a previous life, Shariputra had actually entered the Bodhisattva path. That means he developed spontaneous bodhicitta. But out of his enthusiasm, he made a mistake. Before he reached the level of stability of bodhicitta, at a certain point, the bodhicitta is said to be like gold. Gold is kind of immutable. It doesn't tarnish the way other things do. You can mold it into other things. So gold-like bodhicitta, before he reached that stage, he was a bodhisattva, he was practicing generosity, and some evil spirit or god came just to test him out and said, I really need something for my practice, it's absolutely urgent. And Shariputra asked him what it was, and he said, I need a right hand. And Shariputra thought, you know, so many lifetimes I've practiced for myself alone. Now here's a chance to give my body for the sake of others. So he cut off his right hand with great pain because he hadn't reached the point yet where he could feel no pain. This. So with great reluctance, he took the right hand and was handing it to this person who was manifesting as a Brahmin. It was some spirit. And the Brahmin said, how dare you? You're handing that to me with your left hand, which is where you would clean off your defecation. Even to this day, people in India, they always offer something with the right hand. You never offer with your left hand, because maybe they still use their left hand, you know. So in that tradition, and so Shariputra, I was going to say like this, but his right hand is gone, so it must have gone like this. How can I work for sentient beings when they're so evil like this? And because his bodhicitta had not become stabilized, it degenerated. So he'd lost the path. In the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, which many of you are familiar with, the guide of the Bodhisattva's way of life, there's a verse that alludes to this in the beginning, when if you read the commentaries, the verse just says, only the omniscient one knows how someone who once generated the mind of bodhicitta can eventually achieve, and gives that up, how can they eventually ever again reach, you know, some holy state. He's referring to Shariputra because, you know, it's like amazing. He gave up the bodhicitta, which is like a very heavy obscuration to the mind. Now I'm beginning to feel the remnants of old age dementia. I forgot why I was telling this story about Shariputra. What was the...
We were talking about Hinayana.
The five paths. Yeah. So Shariputra had actually entered into the Bodhisattva path, but he hadn't gone far enough in so that it was stable. There's certain points, demarcations along the line when you reach something and you won't fall back from that level. So he hadn't reached that point yet, so he left. So on the path of accumulation, you have bodhicitta, spontaneous bodhicitta. At a certain point on that path also, it becomes stable. And you're accumulating merit. You already have bodhicitta, so you're not accumulating merit to generate bodhicitta, but you're accumulating merit to be able to realize emptiness. When you have, on that path, developed shamatha, you've heard of shamatha, right? What's it called? Tranquil abiding, calm abiding? Kind of a samadhi. Unified with vipassana, or special insight. How else do they translate? Special insight? When you have a union of that, tranquil abiding, a special insight, meditating on emptiness, you enter into what's the next path called the path of preparation. It's called, if you call it preparation, it's preparing you to have the path to see emptiness directly. It's preparing you for the path of seeing. That's kind of etymology if you use the word preparation. If you say connection, it's the path that connects you to the path of seeing. So on this path, you have a mental image of emptiness that is factually correct, but it's not a direct image, like still some veils, some obscurations in the mind due to you're realizing emptiness via a mental image. Do you know what that means? We talked before, when I was here before, we talked about mind and mental factors. There's the mind, the mental consciousness has a couple of varieties of experience. One is called direct perception, which we rarely have with our mental consciousness. The most part, our minds, our mental consciousness deal with knowing via conception, conceiving of something, thinking of it. Like right now, can you think of your mother's face? You're not actually perceiving your mother's face. In one sense, you could say you're knowing your mother's face by means of some image in your mind. You might say it's a memory of having seen her, or if someone was described to you, you never met Richard Gere, someone says he looks like this, you could develop a mental image. Even among mental images, there are some that are based on having actually perceived something, some that are based on just description. But at any rate, at this point, you have just a mental image of emptiness, which is correct, but it's not the actual vision. When you have a direct realization of emptiness, you transfer from the path of preparation to the path of seeing. You see, not with your eyeballs, you see with, like, you might say, the wisdom eye, the eye of prajna, or the eye of wisdom. It doesn't mean a physical organ. You see emptiness directly, as though, you know, in the same way you see something with direct perception with your eyes, you know, apple in your hand or avocado in your hand. And then once you've realized emptiness directly, it's at that point you become an Arya being, a superior being. Remember you were asking. And it's at that point you enter the first bhumi. So from the path of seeing, you enter the first bhumi. All the rest of the 10 bhumis are on the path of meditation, the different levels. And on each of those levels, the Arya Bodhisattva, now the one that's realized emptiness, has a special practice of one of the 10 perfections. You usually hear the 6 perfections, right? So there's 4 additional ones after you've completed the perfection of wisdom. So in the Jataka tales, one can sometimes surmise or deduce what bhumi the bodhisattva was on by what perfection he was practicing, what he had a special practice of. So I'm going to read now one. Let me see if I find it here. I have some written down here, some that are in the index. Oh, no, there it is. Is it here? Sorry, I didn't write down the ones here to find the... Maybe it's here. This is another compendium of Jatakas. This one we were reading from before was one of the 6 texts of the Kadambas called the Jataka Mala. It was composed by Aryasura. This is another compendium of Jatakas composed by a great Indian that has more Jatakas than it has... 108, I think. Yes, 108. This is just an English title. It's not that in Sanskrit or Tibetan. Leaves of the Heaven Tree. This is also published by Dharma Publishing. Very, very good companion to that. And I think the one I'm looking for is here, but I'm not sure. Anyway, we'll see it. I have it in the... Okay. Yeah, I think that's it. So the word for patience, do you know the word for patience in Sanskrit? The sage Kshanti's demonstration of patience. K-S with a, of course, K-S-H-A-N-T-I. Do you know what patience is in Tibetan? Sopa. I remember Lama Sopa Rinpoche's teacher, right? His guru. Sometimes Lama Yeshe would be kind of wrathful with Lama Sopa, not because he was angry with Lama Sopa, but Lama Sopa was kind of like the Like in a comedy team, one guy acts as the foil for the other. What is that called? The fall guy or
guy.
The straight man or something. Lama Zopa would act perplexed by something and Lama Yeshe would, you know, say something harsh to him and he would all say, Sopa! You know, but it was for our benefit. It was like Lama wouldn't say that directly to us. It was a way of saying it to us by criticizing Lama Zopa. Lama Zopa had no faults, you know. So, shanti in Sanskrit means sopa in Tibetan. Same word, right? Just a different, like dog in Pero or something like that. So, in this text, this is on page 193, the sage Shanti's demonstration of patience. And this begins also with a little, just a line, a teaching in accord with the perfection of patience. So, this would mean... He was on the first bhumi, after reaching the third path of seeing, is the first bhumi, and then the second, third, fourth, fifth. On the second bhumi, you have a special practice of the perfection of giving, which will, some of these exemplify giving. Second bhumi, you have a special practice of the perfection of ethics or morality. Third bhumi, special practice in the perfection of patience. So one can surmise he may very well have been on the third bhumi in this explanation. Also, this book is very beautiful. It has kind of like a tanka of each of these 108 stories. Each one has its own kind of tanka. Do you see that? Incredibly beautiful. And on the back side, it explains different, you know, it's referring to different one of, like there are 1, 2, 3, 4 of the Jatakas in that tanka. So I think the first one is this little part in the upper left-hand corner of that is talking about this, I think. We'll see. The Bhagavan was staying in a forest, wilderness, teaching the Dharma. On one occasion he smiled, and Shakra then asked the Buddha why he was smiling. And the Buddha answered, the Tathagata does not smile with... Oh, no. Shakra asked him, he said, the Tathagata does not smile without cause, he continued. The Buddha replied, I smiled in remembrance of a previous life. This is how it was. Long ago, a king named Chandana Sandalwood lived in a lush valley bounded by forest solitudes. In the forest lived a sage called Shanti, delight in patience, since he was totally without anger and abided in meditation. One day Chandana, the king, together with his many queens and their attendants, his harem, went to the forest to disport themselves. I don't know what that means. Disport. Said they have fun. In a forest meadow, Chandana, wearied by all the delights of the day, sat down to rest, kind of nodding off. His queens and their attendants went further into the forest where they saw the sage Shanti. Immediately feeling faith in him, they bowed down before him and humbly sat in front of him. The king, going in search of his queen, so he woke up, they're not around. Where did they go? He's looking around for them. Saw his harem seated in front of the sage. At once, he became fiercely jealous and in anger cut off all the sage's limbs. The sage did not react to the king's action, but continued sitting peacefully as before. After the king returned home with his entourage, all the sages who lived in the forest gathered together and began to curse the king. So Shanti had not died yet. He just cut off his limbs. Shanti said to them, I do not feel even the slightest anger for what was done to me. Do not curse the king. If it is true that I do not feel even the slightest anger, may my limbs be as before. As soon as he said this, his limbs reattached themselves to his body, and all his wounds were healed. The king, however, came down with boils all over his body, died, and was reborn in hell. Then the Buddha said, I was the sage Shanti at that time, and Devadatta was the king Chandana. Devadatta was his cousin, right? Who always was in competition with him. Shakra and the rest of the assembly developed great faith in the armor of patience, after which Shakra returned to his heavenly realm. So this is a very short, just an anecdote of that longer presentation. I'll read another version from the Sutra of the Wise and the Foolish. So I've read two from the Jatakamala. One is a very, very short one from this compendium, The Leaves of the Heaven Tree, that has 108 Jataka tales. And I'm going to read one from another collection of tales that's called the Sutra of the Wise and the Foolish. Very, very popular in Tibet and Mongolia. Obviously shorter. And telling similar kind of stories. Particularly, you can get an idea from the telling about things that people did in the past when they were foolish, creating negative karma to suffer now, and the wise at that time creating virtuous karma when they profited later. So it's kind of like, from that point of view, called the Sutra of the Wise and the Foolish. So this is, in this collection, a similar tale to that one, either referring to another life when the Buddha was also called the Rishi of Patience. You know the word Rishi? You've heard Rishi. Yeah. Maharishi. Great Rishi. You've heard it in that context. Rishi is someone, it's like a saint who lives in isolation, often meditation, and who, if they were to give a prediction, say something, like you can trust it, it's like exactly true, whatever they say, they never lie. And if they make a prediction, it will come true. If they curse you, forget about it. It's going to happen. So you don't want to mess with rishis, right? So Shantavadin, or the patient Rishi. Thus I have heard it one time. The enlightened one was residing in bamboo grove of the Kalandaka bird in the city of Rajgriha. You've heard of bamboo grove, maybe? Yeah. At that time, soon after he had attained supreme enlightenment, the Buddha ordained the five-headed Kaundinya, and thereafter Nadi Kashyapya and 1,000 brothers. No, the Buddha ordained the five first disciples headed by Kaundinya. Kaundinya, so there were the first five disciples, they were all members of the court. Remember, some of the disciples, Devadatta, Ananda, Upali, were his cousins or relatives. They came to become monks. Even before that, some of the ministers who were had been present when Siddhartha was about to be born, and they made prophecies about what would happen. Four of those ministers came later. Four of them made predictions. Either your son will be a universal teacher, like a Buddha, or he will be, a Buddha, enlightened one, or he will be a universal monarch, Chakravartin, you know, to have dominion over all the countries. So the king wanted his son to be that rather than a Buddha or, you know. One of the ministers, Kaundinya, the first one, actually was the only one that prophesied. He didn't have either or. He said he would become a Buddha. So the four ministers and the fifth one, they came and were the first when the Buddha studied with different Vedic scholars, concentration, how to achieve moksha, wasn't satisfied with them. They were with him, those five ministers, and later they were the five that went with him in the 6 years of ascetic practice. They were his five disciples. Then when he went off, followed the middle way, they got disgusted, they left him, they went to Varanasi. When he achieved enlightenment, they were the first five that he would teach the Dharma to, so he sought them out. So it says, here it says, after he had attained supreme enlightenment, the Buddha ordained the five, those five disciples, headed by Kaundinya, and thereafter, and one of those five was also Asaji, who I said to you, told this abbreviated teaching to Shariputra, Ye Dharma Hetu Prabhava Hetu Sashan. So all of them had some interesting story about them. And thereafter, Nadi Kashyapya and 1,000 brothers. So at this point, the Buddha had already ordained many disciples. After he had adorned many others, and many were endeavoring in the Dharma, all the people of the city of Rajgriha rejoiced with the exceedingly great joy and lauded the enlightened one thus. Ah, the Buddha, the Tathagata, has come to this world, and this is greatly marvelous as he aids all peoples and nations. Rajgriha, what does that mean? Raj? Raja. King. Griha? Yeah, he's, city, the royal city. And they also said the first monk was Kaundinya, because of the five first disciples, he was the first one to achieve, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths to them, he was the first one to achieve nirvana. The first monk was Kaundinya, and he and Narikasyapa, because they were the first to meet the Buddha, are now the first to taste the nectar of the Dharma. When the monks heard this, they reported it in detail to the Buddha. The Lord, the Buddha, the Bhagavan, then said to them, "In times long past, with a firm mind, I made the vow that when I attained enlightenment, I would aid them before all others." Hearing the Buddha's words, the monks asked, "Lord, we beg you to relate how in times long past you made a mighty vow with a mind of compassion." The Buddha said, "Listen well, monks, and bear it in mind, and I shall tell you." This is important for us. Listen well and bear it in mind. Don't be like the cup with a hole in the bottom where you hear the teachings. You know, "Oh yeah, I heard the teaching, but what was it about?" "I don't know. I was thinking about, I was checking my Instagram," and I, you know. So Zoe is like that. Listen well and bear it in mind. Don't forget it. I shall tell you. Long eons ago, monks, eons past counting, past reckoning, past conceiving, beyond telling, there lived the king of Benares by the name of Kalinga. At that time, in the mountains of that country, there dwelt a rishi, remember this saint-like person, who turned out was the previous life of Shakyamuni, by the name of Shantivadin, who lived together with 500 disciples and applied himself to meditation on patience. Upon a certain occasion, the king, together with his queen, ministers, and entourage, went to the mountains to enjoy the scenery and amuse themselves. Already sounds similar to the other one, right? The king became weary and fell asleep, and the queen and her entourage went into the forest to admire the flowers, where they saw the rishi Shantivadin, his body unmoving, sitting in serene majesty. A mind of faith was born in the queen and her attendants. Am I supposed to stand up, though? And they made offerings of various kinds of flowers, and sitting down before the rishi, listened to the Dharma. And they're like, wow. This, you know, by his, just his aura, his vibration. When the king awoke, he looked about, and seeing that the queen was absent, went into the forest in search of her. Also the other attendants, meaning his harem. When he spied her and her attendants seated before the rishi, he addressed him, "Have you attained the four stages of ecstasy?" The rishi replied that he had not. The king then asked him if he had attained the four stations of Brahma. The rishi said that he had not. The king then asked him if he had attained the four dhyanas. When the rishi said that he had not attained to dhyana, the king became angry and said, "Since you have no attainments, you are a scoundrel. Who would trust you here in the deserted place with these women? What do you have to say for yourself living here in this place?" The rishi said, "Here in the mountains, I meditate on patience." So, just some background. What, when he said, "Have you achieved the four stages of ecstasy, or have you attained the four stations of Brahma? Have you attained the four dhyanas?" More or less talking about the same thing. Do you know what the four dhyanas are? Not Princess Diana. That's Diana. This is Dhyana, right? Dhyana, you may know this. Do you know that word, Dhyana? You may know the Pali version. Do you know the Pali version of Dhyana? Dhyana? Jhana. People say, "Oh, they've achieved the first jhana, the second jhana." Have you ever heard that? So right now we are inhabiting what's called the desire realm. We are dominated by desire of the appearances we have. There are more subtle realms of existence that we would call, you know, like sometimes we talk about the human realm, the god realm, the asuras and the gods. Amongst the gods, the devas, there are different kinds. There are devas of the desire realm, like us, like the ones that in the Roman mythology and Greek mythology had looked down, came down, and interacted with people and things like that. But there are higher devas, higher gods, in what's called the form realm and the formless realm. Have you heard that before? So in the form realm and in the formless realm, there are different levels. Let's say in the form realm, there are four main levels, slightly more elevated, more glorious experience. In those realms, the beings that are born there, they have a mind which doesn't have the desire, the delusions of the desire realm. They have their own delusions, their own afflictions, more subtle. They still have delusions. They're not free of afflictions, delusions, but they're more subtle. They're free of the delusions of our realm if you're born there. We can achieve, even without being born there, through meditation, you can achieve the mind of those four levels that are called the four dhyanas. So when you meditate on... it's a lot of information. Are you getting bored?
No.
Is it okay? Yeah, there you go. One of you has to make a bulleted list. Is this getting too boring for you there? No? Okay. So, how do you achieve those four states? When you remember the term vipassana we talked about earlier. In order to achieve vipassana, first you need to have tranquil abiding, shamatha. What that is, that means you have a single-pointed concentration. It takes a lot of effort to develop that. You have to accumulate a lot of merit to have the sort of the sustenance to achieve that. That's like a clear pool of water in analogy. Within that state of mind, you want to start to analyze. It's like putting in that clear pool of water a little koi fish goldfish. At first, because you're not skilled, you've developed this concentrated mind without any interrupting thoughts. The mind is very calm and clear. When you start to try to analyze within it, like the Four Noble Truths or the defects of the desire realm and the advantages of the form realm, you introduce some perturbation into the calmness. So it's as though the fish in the pool are bringing up some dust and mud from the bottom. It's kind of like some of the conceptual minds arising, and also the tranquility of the mind, like the ripples on the top. Sometimes when the fish go in the pond, you can see little ripples on the top. So you have to develop within that calm state of mind the ability to navigate, to analyze within it without bringing up distracting thoughts and without losing the tranquility of the mind. The development of that ability is, when perfected, is called vipassana, penetrative insight or higher insight. Right? When you have that ability to analyze within tranquil abiding, there are different routes you can take. You can use that vipassana in the mundane way. It's called mundane vipassana. What you do is you analyze the defects of the desire realm, short lives, inferior pleasures to the form realm, the first form realm. It doesn't have the defects, all of these delusions that we have here, gross anger, no anger at all. Different kind of desire, not the gross desires that leave us, sort of without what we were talking about this morning, like heartbroken or. So one analyzes the defects of the desire realm, the advantages of the first form realm, again and again, concentrating in that way. And at a certain point, when one has developed vipassana, one is said to separate from the delusions, the afflictions of the desire realm, and you achieve the first concentration, the first dhyana. That mind, even though you have a human body, your mind is elevated in a certain way, and even when you rise from that meditation, it is separated from the gross delusions for some time, and unless you may, if you get start to get involved in the world again, you go to the market, you start, someone argues with you, and your concentration ability loosens. You could fall from that. Once you even have the preparation for the first dhyana, that creates a, what's called unchangeable karma. You ever heard of unchangeable karma? Immovable karma? What does that mean? Generally, karma that we create, virtue and non-virtue and neutral, is said to be changeable. That means it might ripen in a human realm, might ripen as birth is a hell realm, might ripen as the animal realm, like you're talking about the rich dog. You know, the karma to be rich could ripen as a human. It just depends. It's changeable. But some immovable karma means, like this kind of karma, having achieved the preparation for the first dhyana, you create the karma to be born after this lifetime in the first dhyana. Not just to have a human body with a mind elevated to that level, but actually have a subtle body in the form realm. So this is, these, when he's talking about these four stages of ecstasy, the four stations of Brahma, the form realm is also called the Brahma realm. Because one of the beings in the fourth realm recognizes himself as being, when the universe comes into existence, that's the first realm that's repopulated. It's like everything comes after him. He thinks he's the creator. Like in Vedic mythology, Brahma is the creator, right? Were you versed in Vedic lore when you were in India? Or you were not in India?
I was. I studied yoga in India.
Oh, you studied yoga in India. Okay. So sometimes people who come from Hindu family or Vedic family, they know all of these legends. You know, Brahma is like the of the various gods, Brahma is called the creator. Right? So this is all referring to, the king is asking him if he has any of these high meditative states. Actually, from the Buddha's point of view, once you develop vipassana, rather than developing those four dhyanas and having all sorts of psychic powers, if you instead focus on the Four Noble Truths and emptiness, that's called supra-mundane vipassana, not mundane vipassana. Supra means what? Not super. Supra means beyond mundane. Uncontaminated. So you could use that state to develop wisdom of emptiness or to develop these four dhyanas. In the time of the Buddha, oftentimes the monks, especially in the Theravada tradition, they would cultivate these four dhyanas because they were kind of like way stations, like a vacation. Like when things got too much, you go to the first dhyana, all of the worries of the world go away, you know, of your aches and pains, and you come back. You know, who was that? You said you knew Ajahn Brahm is in Australia.
Yeah.
So Ajahn Brahm is a British monk in the Theravada tradition. I met many years ago in France. He actually studied physics also earlier. Ajahn Brahm's become quite famous in Australia. He comes to Singapore a lot and has a big following. Quite funny and quite good teacher. And he mentioned to me that his monks, they cultivate the four dhyanas. In the time of the Buddha, it was more easy because you kept your vows at that time in the presence of the Buddha and the inspiration. You could achieve tranquil abiding and penetrative insight and have this. It's kind of like, remember we used the expression eye candy before? It's kind of like the monk's mind candy. And man. And also, to be, you have to be careful because so pleasant, you know, you have to be scolded by the disciplinarian. Don't spend all your time in the first dhyana. Get back here. It's a water to carry and, you know, tea to make or something like that. So the king was asking him if he had any of these qualities. The rishi said, no, I'm just a simple. The rishi said, Here in the mountains, I meditate on patience. The king quickly drew his sword and said, so you meditate on patience, do you? Well, I'm going to kill you. We'll see about this patience of yours. And he cut off the rishi's two hands. Now, who are you? Asked the king. The rishi replied, I'm Shantivadin, the practitioner of patience. The king then cut off the rishi's two feet and asked, who are you now? You know, kind of expecting him to beg for mercy or something. Again, the rishi replied, I'm Shantivadin, the practitioner of patience. What did it say? The patient rishi. At that moment, the heavens and the earth trembled in six ways. Remember when the hand of the guy fell off when he pointed? It says, sometimes karma can ripen even in the environment. Have you ever taken elaborate Buddhist sattva vows with a teacher? Sometimes with a very elaborate ceremony that may go on for many hours, it's mentioned that be aware now, because if someone actually develops bodhicitta now, there will be trembling of the earth in these six ways. It's sort of like, I wonder sometime, maybe when you hear about earthquakes, maybe there's someone in that area who generated bodhicitta. So it's like so dramatic. Even the environment changes. A lot, yeah, there's a lot of bodhisattvas out there. But also there must be a lot in Oklahoma for that reason also, where they're doing the fracking. So you can't judge that way. I'm just joking, okay. At that moment, the heavens and earth trembled in six ways, and the rishi's 500 disciples came flying through the air to where he was. Seeing him, they asked, teacher, while undergoing these unbearable sufferings, have you not lost the thought of patience? The rishi answered, my mind has not been separated from patience in the least. So he's probably on the third bhumi, the bodhisattva at this time, who eventually would become Shakyamuni. Thereupon the king became terrified and said to the rishi, rishi, when you said that you were the Shantivadin, who would have believed it? The rishi said, my words are not false. Remember, rishis, one of the qualities of a rishi is what they say is true. If they are indeed true, may my blood become milk and my limbs which were severed become as they were formerly. If my words are not false, if they are indeed true. So what's that referring to? Do you know that? When we talk about the words of truth, we have some prayers in our, when we bless the offerings. Do you know there's a mantra of the words of truth?
I don't know that
one. In your, could I see your prayer book for a second? This young, yeah, you had one. No, that's whoever. Yeah, no, this is a Venerable Siddha. My Venerable too. Her old legs. So, let's see here. Blessing the speech. And even in the blessing the speech was this mantra. If you look on page 17, dependent related heart mantra. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetu teshan. If you want to know, that's the mantra. That's with om at the beginning and svaha at the end. That's what Asaji said to Shariputra, remember? Then, let's see here. Question, Rama. What am I looking for? Words of truth. Yeah, probably here. When you're blessing the offerings. Page 25, is it? Maybe. Extensive power of truth, yeah. Konchok sumgi dempadang sangge dang jangshub sempa tamshegi chingi labdang sogni yongsu sokpe naktang chembodang chuki ying nam padak ching samgi mikyape topki chuk. Oh, Rinpoche's added more lines here. Chuk chu na shukpe sangge dang jangshub sempa tamshe dang Pakpa jump kunsa sambo la sokpe. He didn't add this also in some versions. Rampa chupe tingi pumbo samgi mi kape shemi shepa namgi kangwa gyur. So, Khonsho Sungi Dempadang, by the power, well, it says, Khonsho Sungi Dempadang, the truth of the three jewels. Khonsho Sungi means the three jewels, the Triratnam. Huh? Like, they are something that actually exists. They're not imagination. Sangye Dang Jangshub Sampatam Cheki Jingi Lapdang, the blessings, by the truth of the blessings of the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas. And by the truth, the word truth only comes at the very end, by the truth of the great wealth of the two completed collections, Sogni Yongsu. So the two collections, what are the two collections? Red Cross and the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom, right? So all of these things are true. By the truth of these, may these offerings that I have imagined here be experienced by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So there are many examples of great beings in the past who simply invoking the power of truth. By the fact that I myself have practiced only for the benefit of others, may my limbs be restored, or something like that, comes in some of the sutras. So here he's calling on, the Bodhisattva is calling on the power of truth. Simply by that. It's not just like saying, by the power of truth of me being a member of Kadampa Center, may I have $1,000,000. That's not going to work. But by the power of something which is veritably true, when you have deep realization, sometimes what you are wishing for can actually be accomplished right then and there. So the Rishi said, my words are not false. If they are indeed true, so he's calling on the power of truth, may my blood become milk and my limbs which were severed become as they were formerly. When the Rishi had thus spoken, his blood became milk and his limbs appeared as before. It was the same situation here, right? Seeing this, the king was even more frightened and said, great Rishi, I have harmed you because of ignorance and sin. I confess these sins to you. Do you have compassion on me? The Rishi said, it was because of the women that you cut off my limbs with a sword. This did not harm me because my patience is like the earth. When I shall have attained enlightenment of a Buddha, I shall cut away your three poisons with the sword of wisdom. When the gods and nagas of that mountain saw the king had harmed the Rishi, they were enraged and stirred up the clouds and brought them together. The nagas roared and sent down thunderbolts from the sky, and the king and those with him, about to be killed, became terrified and cried, great Rishi, have compassion, save us! When the Rishi commanded the gods and nagas not to harm the living beings for his sake, they became calm and disappeared. Like the deer also, you know, not wanting retaliation. When we do the Guru Puja, is it Thursday night? There's one verse when talking about the perfection of patience on the glance meditation on the Lan Rim. Kamsam kegyum magyur drugyur te sheshing sanduk dipchik sokchil kyan mituk nolen pempa drupre pe sope barchin so barchin girap. Please grant me blessings to perfect the practice of patience. Right here. Even if all of the beings in the three realms were to get angry at me, who abuse me, find, you know, enumerate my faults, you know, you're this, threaten me or even kill me. In response to their harm, may I benefit them. May I respond to their harm, may I return their harm with benefit. Usually when someone harms us, we return harm. You know, you hit me, I hit you. Jesus, what did Jesus say? Someone were to smote you on one, what memory I have of Christians from when I was a little boy. If someone were to smote you on one cheek, you should offer the other cheek. You know? He didn't go as far to say you should benefit them, you should just be even more patient. So here, even in the Buddhist perception, even more so. The king, having confessed his sins, invited the rishi to his palace and honored him with various kinds of offerings. When 1,000 mendicants who followed other teachers saw the king and his entourage honoring the rishi, Shantivadin, and believing in him, they became envious and threw filth on the rishi. Right?
Really?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I believe. The mendicants who at that time threw filth on me are now Nadi Kashyapa and the 1,000 monks. Some of his first disciples. They were the ones that threw filth on me then. Where is it? My meditation on patience at that time was a vow that when I should have attained supreme enlightenment, I would cleanse their impurities with the waters of Amrita and would totally purify their attachments. O monks, do not think that at that time, under those circumstances, the Rishi Shantivadin was anyone else but me. Because that was me. Kaundinya, the first of the 5 disciples that attained arhatship, Kaundinya and the 4, so they're the 5 first disciples, were King Kalinda and his 4 ministers at that time. When at that time I meditated on patience, I vowed that when I attained supreme enlightenment, I would first liberate them from suffering, and now that I have attained Buddhahood, I have indeed liberated them first. The monks had faith in the Buddha's word and greatly rejoiced. So there are other renditions of this. Either there's the Buddha on many occasions appeared in the world as a rishi meditating on patience, slightly different stories, or they're referring to the same situation that the Buddha mentioned in different contexts, emphasizing certain facets. These two stories were quite similar. In other stories that you find, like say, for instance, in the Majjhimaka teachings, when it talks about the different bhumis, the different perfections, the patience, it does mention also when the Buddha was Shantivadin, and gives more details about first the king cut off his ears, one ear, then the other ear, then his nose, then his tongue. So he didn't go here. He immediately went to his hands, right? Maybe this is abbreviated, maybe it's another time, you're not sure. Then he cut off his hands, his feet, his legs, and never lost that concentration on patience. So that kind of indicates that the Bodhisattva was on the third bhumi. You kind of get that impression. Could have been other places, but especially on that. On the first bhumi, remember, what does that mean? The person is already a bodhisattva on the 5 paths. They pass the path of accumulation, the path of preparation. They're now on the path of seeing. They see emptiness directly, and they have a special surpassing practice of the perfection of generosity. So one of the stories we will talk about after the break, when the Buddha, there are many of these Jatakas telling about how the Buddha, the bodhisattva, was able to give away, you know, so many things. It's sort of remarkable. So is it a good time to take a break? Too soon? No. Not good? Okay. It's almost 3:12. Okay, so 3:15? 3:15, okay. Start back. Thank you.